Oh, you know, I have a thing, a bone to pick with you, sir. Yeah.
What did I do?
Well, let me tell you. I have worn my Super Yaki Simulate t-shirt for every recording of this miniseries so far, and you have not commented or noticed once.
I have noticed each time.
Well, you haven't commented. I'm just saying, Jamie, like, I'm putting my game face on here, okay? I'm suiting up. I don't see you wearing fucking Pinot Grigio swag for this. I'm showing you that I'm excited. I'm happy to be here.
It's true.
I'm getting nothing from you.
I'm wearing a Merlot t-shirt right now.
You're just not even on brand. It's like you're wearing your away team uniform for a home game.
You know, I've never seen a Pinot Gris t-shirt.
Well, they probably don't make them in men's sizes. You're burnt, ladies. You're burnt.
You burnt suburban white women who drink it by the gallon.
Yeah. Well, you drink everything by the gallon. All right. Are you ready?
I don't know. Welcome, y'all.
Welcome
to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about movies and wine.
I don't need to correct you here. It is a podcast about movies and wine.
I just thought that you might have some snide comment or some sort of a funny thing to say.
Jamie, I think my funny is depleted, okay? You're going to have to step up, all right? You're the, like, quote-unquote knowledgeable one, and I'm the funny, cute one on the show, and I don't have it today, all right? The sky is falling, Jamie Little, all right? Or I guess I'm Chicken Little.
I got to be honest with you, Scott. I don't think either of us is knowledgeable or funny.
No, I'm definitely the funny one of the two of us. You're the dusty professorial one who, like, takes his wine thing very seriously, and I'm the class clown who makes fun of you. I'm the funny one, and I don't know.
I think that's not true.
I think in real life we're equally the funny one, and I think on the show I'm the funny one. I think that's my role.
Your role is to be the funny guy. I'm the straight man, essentially.
I mean you could say that, or I don't know. I'll throw you a bone, Jamie. You're the cute one, okay? Like by boy band standards, I'm the funny one. I'm the clown, and you're the cute one.
And I'm the cute one. Okay, I'll take that.
Yeah, I thought you would.
Extremely cute.
Yeah, I appealed to your vanity so we can move off of this topic. but it is a podcast about movies and wine.
For those of you out there who don't know shit about one or both of these topics, that's movies and wine, I'm Jamie, I'm the wine guy.
I am Scott, I'm the movie guy, and we, Jim Jam and I, are here to help you. Now, normally, each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves. We're kind of doing that today.
We're sort of doing that.
This isn't so abnormal.
Normally, we tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. We're also sort of doing that today. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Sometimes we don't. Today,
usually we don't. I think at this point, we just have to give up and say that usually we don't. And that's okay. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Usually we don't. And that's okay. It's okay. We're giving ourselves a break.
We always have fun on the voyage.
That's true. The voyage home.
This is the fifth episode of our miniseries, Pinot Grigio versus the M4 Tricks, or turns out in my matrix, the worse we treat you, the more we manipulate you, the more Pinot Grigio you produce. I've been setting productivity records for years since I took over.
All right, Jamie, I'm going to direct you a little bit here. I want you to do another take, and I need you to give me like 50% more shit-eating grin.
You didn't see me, but there was a shit-eating grin on my face when I did it.
Well, you got to eat a little bit more shit then, okay? Because NPH is such a piece of shit in that scene. He really is.
But, like, it's so fucking good.
You got to eat a little bit more shit, Jamie, to really sell it.
You want me to do it one more time?
I'm asking for another line reading.
Do more it. Shit. Okay, more I'm going to try and eat more shit on this take.
Yeah, I am not eating one iota of shit, but you are going to have to eat a very healthy portion.
Today, the wine that we're focusing on is the 2019 The Eyrie Pinot Gris.
And on movie side, we continue our lengthy, probing, multi-pronged analysis of 2021's The Matrix Resurrections, co-written and directed by Lana Wachowski. And today we are just talking about the antagonistic character of the analyst, as played quite douchily by Neil Patrick Harris.
By a shit-eating Neil Patrick Harris. So this wine.
Yeah, I'm pouring some. I've got my nicely chilled bottle right here. I'm pouring a little glass. Had a little bit last night.
I've been sipping on it already a little bit.
Yeah, I can tell.
It's yummy.
Is it? Is it though?
Do you not think this is yummy?
No, I do not. I do not care for this at all, my friend.
I am stunned by that.
Really? Because it, the staggering amount of grapefruitly bitterness in this, I really feel like it shouldn't be a surprise to you that I do not care for this wine.
There have been plenty of wines that taste like grapefruit that you've liked. You just don't like grapefruit itself, which is a bad opinion, but we'll forgive you for it.
I don't. It's not setting my toes a-tapping, Jim Jam. I am not a fan.
What? So so bitterness. You don't like the bitterness. What else about it don't you like?
Oh, my God. Why is there so much bitterness? Why does it have to taste like that? Why is that desirable?
It's not that bitter.
I feel like it's pretty bitter. And I feel like the bitterness is preventing me from tasting other things that are probably going on in the wine. Like I get a hint of sugar and citrus up front, and then there's just this crushing wave of bitterness that just makes me like make a cranky cat face. Like it's just terrible. I don't care for the bitterness. It smells nice. It smells better than it tastes to my nostrils. There's some kind of minerality on the nose I was getting. I don't know what kind. I don't go around sniffing and licking rocks the way you do, but some kind of minerality on the nostrils. Again, like I get a hint of sugar and maybe a hint of citrus, and then it's just all astringency. And this feels higher alcohol than the label says. The label says it's 13%, and I am surprised that it was that low.
I think it tastes like a 13% wine. I think the bitterness is very much in check. I'm not certain. Like maybe, I don't know, maybe you've got a bottle that is, there's maybe some kind of bottle variation, but this producer is typically very good about that and not having problems that way. I'm a little shocked that that the bitterness is so much in the forefront for you.
Yeah, I'm, and it doesn't feel like anything is wrong. Like I don't have that perceptive or experienced of a palate, but I drink this and I'm like, oh, I see why Jamie likes it. And I will begrudgingly finish the bottle. But
interesting.
I was getting last night a bit of like a coconut thing that I've gotten with a bunch of these Pinot Gris and Pinot Grigios. Mm-hmm. Maybe not getting it as much now because this is chilled. I did have it room temp last night. Oh, and I do have a positive note. I really like the mouthfeel. It's very wet.
Oh, my God. It's wet.
I'm joking, but I do genuinely like the mouthfeel.
I like the mouthfeel here, too. There's a lot of texture to it.
The texture is coming with the bitterness, and maybe the bitterness just is the texture. I can't really say, but there's like a, I don't know, it feels wet to me, Jamie, and not like I'm being, you know, stupid about the dry sweet spectrum, but it feels light and the body doesn't, is it medium? Is it medium body?
Medium, yeah. Maybe medium plus, but like,
I don't know, man. You
know, the high end of medium.
It feels wetter than the... Oh, God, it just burns. It's just so bitter and high alcohol. Ugh.
Bitter and high alcohol. It's really... In going through all of these Pinot Gris and Pinot Grigios, I think the Chauffite and the Schioppetto were the ones that showed the most bitterness. And we talked about that phenolic bitterness being firmly like a varietal character of Pinot Gris / Grigio. We talked about it in the first episode, and I think it was very present in the Schioppetto. I think it's definitely here, but I really am not perceiving it the way that you are. I'm getting a lot more fruit character. For me, it's got like almost... It's got this mealy golden apple and this lemon and lime zest thing, but it also has almost an artificial fruitiness, almost like Sprite to it. And then that minerality, which I would call slate. It's got a little bit of like a bread or brioche type character that leads me to believe that there was some lees contact, and I know that there was. I think that there's really nice acidity on this wine. The body's about medium. I think the alcohol's in check. It doesn't scream out to me in any way. And that texture, that little extra tannin, I think, comes from about 4 days of skin contact that this wine gets prior to fermentation.
That's actually tannin, then. That's not some other type of phenolic bitterness.
Correct.
A rare tannin in a white wine.
Mm-hmm.
You said something that I found compelling. You were talking about the lees contact, and you were saying, I detect lees contact, but which I also know that there's lees contact. How much do you wine people have to run into like checking your own confirmation bias about something?
A lot. That's why one of the reasons why we blind taste as often as we do is to have that particular mechanism calibrated. You know, the number of times that I have been, you know, blind tasting and mistaken Lee's contact for oak or vice versa, or missed an indicator because I was focusing too much on a note that I found really compelling. Like if I smell, let's just say for argument's sake, violets in a wine, and I find that to be really interesting, and then I fixate on that and I'm thinking that the wine is something different, and I just ignore the fact that there is a coconutty mascarpone Parmesan rind thing, then I might make the call wrong. Blind tasting is the check on that bullshit.
Well, it's good you guys have like a mechanism for it so that you're not just sniffing your own farts and saying they're violets.
Right. We're also sniffing our own farts, but we try anyway to like detect things and say the correct things in good faith.
Ugh.
You just think it's bitter alcohol, huh?
I mean, like, it's not just bitter alcohol. There's a hint of something that I like up front and then crushed by bitter alcohol.
I think it's fucking super yummy. I'm completely confounded. Of all of the wines that I've chosen that we've disagreed on, this is the one that I'm most shocked by.
I can't help you. I'm sorry. It is, you know, this is what my mechanism is telling me. Well, you gave me a pairing recommendation last time, and then I totally forgot about it until after I had dinner and opened the bottle at like 10:30 when Tani got home last night. What did you say this should go with? What did you say this should go with food-wise?
I probably said sushi. Yeah, I said sushi.
I had it with sushi, and that didn't help at all.
Another thing that happens, like, I'm not going to assign this to you necessarily, but like, it's happened with me where I pick up on something that I don't like in a wine, and then that's all I can perceive. And I end up not liking that. And then, you know, months or years later, I'll revisit the wine and find out that I do in fact like it. And I was just fixating on one thing. I'm not going to say that that's the thing that's happening here, but it has happened to me before.
I enjoy it in the front palate. Like just swishing it around up front with my cheeks and my tongue, like up against my teeth. That just sounds gross, even just saying it out loud. But just swishing it around up front there, totally on board. And then the swallow is like, oh, God, oh, what are we doing? Spit it back out. It's better that way.
Very, very interesting, Scotty. I'm shocked. I'm surprised. I'm sorry that you don't like it. I wish you did.
You're not sorry. You don't have to be sorry.
No, I am. I like to give people wines that they like.
Well, okay. I'm going to tell you right now, I'm not going to apologize to you for any of the movies that you don't like, which I think we were at like a total of two so far for the show.
Yeah. Yeah. Tenet and The Rider.
And Dick Johnson Was Dead. Is Dead.
No, I like Dick Johnson Was Dead. Is Dead.
You just had moral and ethical issues with it.
Yes, I did.
Right. Just like you had moral and ethical issues with The Rider.
Yeah, but those prevented me from liking the movie.
Right.
Mine with Dick Johnson Is Dead did not.
Yeah.
Which is interesting to say out loud.
Yeah.
I think that this wine is showing a level of skill and care in the winemaking, very much like Schioppetto did. That, like, we know how to make a technically sound wine, but we're also really paying attention and keyed into what's going on in the vineyards. And that's one of the reasons why I really like this wine and this winery. You know, when I think about Oregon Pinot Gris, this is the first winery that comes to mind. Honestly, when I think about Oregon, this is the first winery that comes to mind. The reason is that in the modern era, from the 60s until now, they were very much the first. David Lett, in 1965, planted the first vines in the Willamette Valley. And it's kind of crazy to think that the Willamette or the Oregon wine industry is that young. Willamette Pinot Noir specifically is so well regarded and so widely known that it's difficult to conceive of how quickly the industry both was created and matured.
That's kind of the story of American wine, though, right? I saw that California wine movie, Bottle Shock, with Alan Rickman. the whole deal with that was that, like, the American wine industry was so young and so under-respected in the old world of France that, like, they were Rocky. They were the young underdogs coming up and punching above their weight class.
For sure.
Right? Is that so different in Willamette?
Well, what's another American wine region that commands the amount of respect that Willamette Valley does?
Well, okay, I can name you three American wine regions. So Napa Valley and Sonoma.
There you go. Napa Valley is the one that I was looking for. Napa's the easy comparison. And the modern age of Napa winemaking did start, you know, meaningfully in the 50s. So only 10 years ahead, but there was a ton of pre-prohibition activity in California more broadly, and also specifically in Napa Valley. Napa Valley has a bunch of old vine vineyards that were planted in the latter half of the 19th century. Winemaking culture was there prior to the modern age of winemaking that we know now as Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon. The same is not at all true of the Willamette Valley. Willamette Valley was a hazelnut and fruit tree production area prior to 1965.
So this is a real big balls move on his part, is what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah, the story is kind of crazy. So David Lett, when he was born, he was supposed to be a doctor. His grandfather did the thing that a lot of parents or grandparents do to their children, which is assign them a job at birth. You know, David was obedient in that he, you know, left high school and pursued a pre-med program. And he stayed an extra year to get a philosophy degree because apparently at the time, having some amount of liberal arts on your resume helped you get into med school. And then he didn't get into any med schools. And then while he was trying to get into dental schools, he chanced to do some tasting in Napa Valley. And then as a result of that, decided to enroll at UC Davis rather than pursuing a medical career. And he got a degree in viticulture. And while he was at UC Davis, he fell in love with Pinot Noir and specifically with Burgundy. And he also was really disappointed by the California examples of Pinot Noir. And so he wanted to find a place outside of Burgundy to plant Pinot Noir. And after school, he took 8 months and did a bunch of research in Europe, specifically in Burgundy, but also all around France and a little bit in Germany. Came back to California, was speaking with his professors, collected about 3,000 cuttings from the nursery at UC Davis, and based on some climate data and soil data that he had seen, took the trip up to the Willamette Valley to go pursue his dream of planting a vineyard, having never been there before.
This seems like an awfully big swing for him to have taken.
Well, I mean, when you consider that he was 25 years old when he did it, that's certainly part of the story, right? Just filled with piss and vinegar and thinking that he's going to go out there and put his stamp on the world. The audacity of youth, right, is part of this story.
Jamie, I didn't care for that detail.
What? Which detail?
At 25, I believe I'd failed out of college twice. And at 25, he went to a liberal arts college, traveled the world, did cuttings and climate samples, and then invented an entire wine industry in Oregon.
Well, I mean, this is also a period of time during which you could have a job that paid you $5,000 a year, and you could own property, be married, and start a family on that money.
Jamie, knock it off with your fucking liberal economics bullshit, okay? The Republicans are right, and millennials are stupid and lazy, and we should all just be trying harder, even though we're all saddled with like six figures of, you know, college debt, or trapped in fucking low-paying, shitty service jobs, or entry-level positions at salaries that, like, 40 years ago, our parents could have bought a house on, and, you know, we have to have three roommates to live with.
What we were talking about, the audacity of youth.
At first, it sounded to me like you were pitching this as, like, I don't know, it just felt like, man, this is a big, dumb swing that this guy took, and he sure did get lucky, but also, it seems like he really did the work and the research to actually pick a smart place to try and compete with Burgundy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for sure, he did a lot of work and a lot of research, not so much research that he actually visited the place, before he bought property there and started plant and like went up there with vines to put in the ground.
He bought property before going there?
Yes.
All right. That's crazy.
I agree.
Never mind, David. I was going to give you credit for being like an extremely thoughtful and well-possessed 25-year-old. But instead, no. Buying property before you go somewhere. What if he gets there and he's like, man, this is like perfect soil and the pH is wonderful and I'm going to grow some great grapes. But like, oh, I don't like the way the clouds look. Like, fuck, sorry, dude. You bought land. You're trapped now.
Then it would have been a big failure.
Or he would have just, you know, been like quietly miserable his entire life because he hated the shape of the clouds in Willamette Valley.
And who's to say he wasn't quietly miserable for his entire life?
That's true.
I'm told, Scott, that most men lead lives of quiet desperation.
I am also told that, yes.
I don't necessarily think it's true, but I've heard it.
Well, you and I disprove that, Jamie, because we live lives of very loud and frequently complaining desperation.
That is 100% correct.
That's right.
Some people are quiet about it.
Yeah. Is quietly desperate.
I was exactly going.
Yes.
That was the first one that came to mind. Little guy. You're 100% right that this is an insane swing that he took. It's absolutely the kind of thing that I respond to and that you respond to, I think, in the episode that just released today as of this recording. But episode 33, we talk about, you know, an ambitious misfire versus a safe success.
Yeah, we like a big swing.
And this is a big swing that succeeded in a huge way, not just for the Eyrie Vineyards, but for Oregon more broadly. These 3,000 cuttings of Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Pinot Gris, and Riesling turned into a giant wine industry. And I'm pretty sure that they're the fifth largest producer of grapes in the United States. It's like California, Washington, New York, maybe they're fourth. Another thing that I find really cool about this wine, specifically the Pinot Gris, is that the Pinot Gris plantings that David Lett made in Willamette in 1965, these were the first commercial Pinot Gris plantings outside of Europe. That, you know, there had been Pinot Noir in California and in other places. There had been Riesling in Washington State, also in California. There had been Chardonnay very, very broadly in California, but there no one had planted Pinot Gris. David Lett was the first, and it turned into this thing where like the Pinot Gris gave us the first non-European style of Pinot Gris, which we talked about, the character of this wine, and I think it's much more fruit forward than the Schioppetto or the Domaine Chauffite. It's typically very dry. Like this is something singular that can be identified as being from this place. But also it gave wineries in the area a quick to market wine while their Pinot Noir matured, because Pinot Noir takes a long time to mature before you can bottle it. So it's economically important for the area too. And now it constitutes 30% of plantings in Oregon.
So Jamie, I want to remind you back a little bit, because it sounds like what you're saying is that this wine was the first ever New World Pinot Gris.
I mean, if you have to use that phrase.
I mean, I don't have to, but it seems like that is the standard conventional way that wine people describe wines that are not made in Europe. So this is a New World Pinot Gris. Would you agree, Jamie?
I would say that this is a non-European Pinot Gris.
See, that doesn't have the same ring to it. It lacks a certain Eurocentricity that I think we really need to drill down and focus on here.
Oh my God. I hate it. I really do wish that there were better ways of talking about this. The New World bullshit is such a, like, now all I can think about when I hear New World is like colonizers. It still rings in my head whenever I talk about the difference between European wine and wine from not in Europe. There is a in the glass representation. Like you can taste the difference between something from Europe and something not from Europe. So trying to find different ways to talk about it is a challenge.
Yeah. I mean, it's a branding issue. Like New World and Old World, they're easy, they're accessible, they're right there. One of them recalls a tremendous Terrence Malick movie, which is literally about colonizers, but.
I would love it if at some point we could decolonize our thoughts about wine, but I know that like colonization is so wrapped up in the history of wine that that also is basically impossible. So like the middle ground is to, I guess, not center it.
Well, it's like, why do we even, and I say we, but I really mean you, why do you, Jamie, even need that kind of distinction? Like, why can't it just be continental? Why can't it be European wine, North American wine, South American wine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
I mean, it should be. I think that that's definitely a better way of putting it. But there's also, there are similarities, North American, South American, and Australian, and South African wines. Like, there's a through line between all of those things. And it almost certainly is a result of colonization that there is that through line. They have a flavor profile that identifies them as wines that are not from Europe, rather than as a wine from the United States, or as a wine from Chile, or as a wine from South Africa.
So they all have elements in their flavor profile that are distinctly non-European.
Yes.
So were all of those places like reacting to the European wines in a similar way?
I think all of those places were, the viticulture was being built around the same time, which was a different time than when European vineyards were being built. And I don't know, a lot of this is supposition because I'm not a historian and I don't know enough about this topic.
You heard it here first, everybody. Jamie Harrison Rubin. Not a historian. It's okay. In like 20 minutes, you're going to hear that Scott Hudson, not a philosopher.
We would have been great historians and philosophers, though, had we put our minds to it.
Had we tried harder in school.
That's right. No, I think so. I think some of it is, you know, the effect of having been in a colonized area. The attention to quality in the beginning years was lower. There were larger vineyard holdings by, you know, lords or landed people or wealthier people. And there's, I guess, commercialism, it might be part of it. This idea of making a lot of wine rather than like a small amount of really great wine. I do think it's being shaken by a number of different producers all across those places, but you still taste a Carmenere from Chile and it has these markers. It has this ripeness of fruit and this richness that also compares to a Merlot from Napa or a Syrah-based blend from South Africa. Not that they all taste exactly the same, but they have this, like I can identify this as like a Syrah-based blend, but it's definitely not from Europe. Now, is it from Australia or South Africa? That's more difficult to tell.
How much of this is, how do I put this? How much of these similarities between, quote unquote, New World wines, non-European wines, how much of those similarities real? And how much are the similarities in like those kinds of seemingly very artificial groupings that you're making between wines from basically all the continents except one? How much of those groupings are just based on association or difference from England? Like it just feels like the it's the wagon, the dog, you know, it's the cart before the horse. It's the language dictates how we think about it instead of just looking at what's actually being produced. Or like our impression of history is dictating how you guys are talking about it instead of like the actual product.
I think the way we talk about it sometimes dictates how, like, the way things are produced. For example, the Court of Master Sommeliers, the organization that I've been coming up through, I take a lot of issue with the wines that they consider to be classic, quote unquote, the ones that they hold up as examples of regions. For all of those wines, the broad generalities that I've been saying hold true. And I could find a ton of other wines that break all of the generalities that I've made. But the wrestling match that I have with myself is the wines that the court chooses tend to be the ones that are more widely commercially available. Outside of big markets like London, Paris, Tokyo, New York, Philadelphia, LA, you know, big cities. It's harder to find the producers that are focused on breaking the paradigm outside of big cities.
All right, Jamie, put this one now, put the Irie Pinot Gris in the context of the previous four bottles. And you have to do it no longer than it's taken you for any of the previous episodes. I definitely know how long all of those contextualizing miniseries discussions took, and I have a stopwatch here. So you have just as much time to place this in the context of the previous four as you did on the first one to just talk about it and what was going to come next.
Well, I already said a lot of what puts this wine in the context of the miniseries.
Perfect. Moving on.
This, like, the winery defined Pinot Gris for Oregon. The winery defined the wine industry, really, for Oregon, and therefore for the wider United States. Probably Red Newt Cellars wouldn't have planted Pinot Gris had Pinot Gris not been first commercially planted in Oregon by David Lett. And for sure, our next wine would absolutely not exist, and the next winery wouldn't exist were it not for David Lett and his work with Pinot Gris, Pinot Noir, and Chardonnay. It also helped popularize the grape Pinot Gris with consumers in the Pacific Northwest and then for the rest of the country. And then economically, it allowed wineries to be financially solvent quicker by having a quick-to-release wine. As far as the flavor is concerned and in the progression of this miniseries, where does this fall? You know, we've been through Schioppetto, which was the one for me that carried the most bitterness. I know that this is the one for you that carries the most bitterness, but Schioppetto had sort of a sharpness in its profile. Then the Il Ramato from Scarbolo had a softness while still having this almost tannic structure to it. And then we moved into a French example, which had a little bit of residual sugar, followed by the Red Newt, which followed in the Alsatian style, but presented much riper and friendlier in the way that non-European wine tends to, and also showed us that Pinot Gris can age. And so here we are with the first West Coast example of Pinot Gris. And for me, it's this really clean and pristine, you know, it doesn't show any botrytis. It's kind of all about fruit, but it still has this little bit of texture to it, giving it some interest. This is a totally different style from the rest. And then next week we get weird.
Predictions, Jamie. Will I like the final bottle of wine in this here miniseries?
Yeah, I think so.
But you thought I was going to like this one.
I really did.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know. Audience at home, let's make Jamie put out a Twitter poll or a, I don't know, Instagram poll. I don't know how Instagram works. Jamie will put out a poll on the socials and people should guess. Will Jamie be right? Will Scott enjoy the final bottle of wine in this miniseries? Or will it also taste like butts and Jamie will have missed the mark?
It doesn't taste, regardless that it doesn't taste like butts.
Do you think this one tastes like butts?
Nope.
Well, sir, I disagree.
Are you comfortable over there being wrong? Having a bad opinion?
Jamie, there's no such thing as wrong. There's no such thing as right. There's no such thing as anything, Jamie. All right? It's all your subjective experience. We're all just trapped inside our own heads, and it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks.
All right, Mr. fucking French philosophy.
All right, so Jim Jam, we're on the movie side of things. I want to talk about The Analyst. Played by Neil Patrick Harris, he's initially depicted as Thomas Anderson's therapist and is ultimately revealed to be the antagonist of the movie, the successor to the original trilogy's architect, the program, the digital sentience, who has created this new version of the Matrix that Neo and Trinity are trapped in and who are somehow through the love conquers all power of love, they are actually powering this new Matrix that makes everybody fucking miserable and awful. God, like, what a great villain. Like, what an amazing villain for our modern times.
A really unbelievable villain. Just reads as so slimy from the first moment you see him on screen.
It's something Tani and I disagreed about when we were talking about the movie after we'd seen it, that, like, I felt like that line from The Analyst that's in the trailers where Thomas Neo says in one of his therapy sessions, am I going crazy? And he says, we don't use that word in here. And in the trailer, it felt very sinister. And it was like, oh, okay, villain, are you a villain? Is that like a red flag for your villainy there, NPH? And Tani didn't feel that it was like particularly sinister. In the context of the movie, for the first chunk of the film, he genuinely presents as like sincere and warm and helpful and like maybe kind of a good therapist until, you know, it starts becoming apparent that he's just like gaslighting his poor patient. The second time we see him and Tom comes in and right after Morpheus 2 has made his big announcement and we have like the shootout and the awakening of Smith in the video game developer's office. And then Tom just like sort of weirdly magically dissolves into the analyst's office, which we think is like a trick of editing, but it's actually the analyst fucking pulling a deja vu and changing the matrix and dragging him in there. And then suddenly it's like, oh no, I think all of these hallucinations that you're having are perfectly healthy. And it's a way, and it's like, oh wait, no, dude, this doesn't track. You're not good at this. Why are you lying to this man?
I gotta disagree with you on his presentation early in the movie. As a therapist, like before his reveal as the villain, I don't know. Maybe it's because I've been in therapy for as long as I have, and I've never encountered a therapist who talks that much. You know, they're there to listen and to prompt you and to ask a penetrating question and then get out of the way as you answer it yourself. NPH is answering a lot of questions. He's railroading, and that's what it felt like. Like he was trying to direct Tom's thought more than I consider to be appropriate for a therapist.
Well, I guess that's a fair point. Yeah, I have not yet myself entered the world of therapy, though I suspect that I, like most people, would benefit from it.
It really is a lot of help.
Maybe I'm just putting him in the context of like movie therapists, you know, who are often like next to female journalists, like there is no profession more consistently unflatteringly depicted on screen than the therapist. And I say the female journalist just because female journalists in movies and TV shows always end up sleeping with their subjects, which is just like somebody's got an issue with the lady journalist or it's just lazy fucking screenwriting.
It's probably both.
But yeah, therapists are always like, and not always, I shouldn't say always, like there are some very good examples of them, like Dr. Sharon in the second season of Ted Lasso feels to me like a course correction on that really bad trope. But like, just look at any depiction of a therapist in, for example, the works of Aaron Sorkin. It's just like egregious where he's just using the concept of an analyst for exposition and subtext delivery instead of, you know, being a better writer.
Right. I mean, I can't imagine how difficult it would be to write a therapist without being in therapy or having like a general understanding of like cognitive behavioral therapy or any of that kind of stuff. That's not to let Sorkin off the hook because that's just lazy. But I don't know. There's something about the aesthetics of NPH in this movie where he's coded physically very soft and he's got like the hip blue glasses and the blue socks.
Well, he's coded like our new hero. He's got the blue glasses just like Bugs.
That's right.
His visual coding immediately aligns him with the person that the movie tells us right up front. Like, here's one of our new heroes. Bugs is the raddest and she's the best. And she's kind of our audience avatar. And then the analyst shows up a few scenes later and he's got the same blue glasses on. And then when he takes the fucking mask off and he reveals himself to be this super smug piece of shit, and the first thing that happens is he takes the blue glasses off and chucks them away.
Throws them away.
And he's like, I hate lying.
I hadn't interrogated the like parallel between his blue glasses and Bugs's, but kind of what I mean by his aesthetic coding is that like he's shown as a modern therapist who like understands modern emotions and the problems that are presented by living in the world that we have created. And then he goes on to just railroad the discussion. And that for me was the like, oh, this is a bad one. We don't like this one.
And I think a lot of that just comes out of the casting, right? Like there, we talked about this in a previous episode, but there is a quality to NPH and he can just present as villainous, like right away. You know, I think that's part of what works so much about, for example, like his casting in How I Met Your Mother. Barney, like, we know deep down is, like, probably a decent dude because he needs to be, you know, one of our friends on the show. But, like, he's also just, like, a slimy piece of shit. And NPH presents that really well. And he's so much fun to watch in that mode that, like, the whole time through the first half of the movie, you're just, like, waiting for that mask to come off. But I don't know. I genuinely watching that first therapy session before it is just, like, incredibly obvious that he is a tool of the system, if not the architect of the system. It felt to me like there was a genuine desire to help, and it felt like he was maybe even helping, especially that first watch through when, like, I really didn't know if we were just going to spend the whole movie wondering if the Matrix was even real at all, or if we were just living in, like, some kind of, like, super zoomed out meta deconstruction where maybe all of the events of the previous movies were just poor Tom's psychosis that he poured into a video game trilogy.
You mentioned Barney on How I Met Your Mother. I think that is one of NPH's big strengths, is walking that line between bad and good. And that's the effect that you were feeling, that, like, I'm not sure. He's able to show you at once, like, compassion and villainy.
I think it's a genuinely delightful and refreshing and kind of shocking performance. Like, his big monologue in the bullet time 2.0 sequence, so extraordinary. I know a lot of people complain about the visual of that, and we'll talk about it in the next episode, but
it's so good.
It looks so good, and like, thematically, it's so rich, and there's so much tension to it. But his whole, like, I hate lying. Let's just talk like adults. I've talked about it before, the, like, shit-eating grin on his face, the way he kind of, like, cocks his head from side to side, where he's like, I was there when you died, you know? Like, oh, God, fuck you, buddy. Like, he's having such a good time playing villains. I hope, just like we talked about with Groff last time, that I hope that Resurrections opens a door for Groff to do all kinds of different things than we've seen him do before. Oh my God, I would love to see a whole string of, like, NPH villain performances. Like, put NPH as the villain in a fucking Marvel movie. Like, I don't care what character. I just want to, like, see that guy be smug and chew the scenery with a bunch of action figures.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. That would get me out to watch a Marvel movie.
Yeah, the presentation of the analyst as a therapist is really interesting. It was one of the things that, of the, like, many topics in the movie for the brief 5 minutes that it dominated the zeitgeist in between people's screenings of Spider-Man No Way Home, the super spreader event of the year. Like, that was one of the very divisive elements, was this depiction of therapy in the movie. And I remember reading a bunch of takes on Twitter and people pushing back on the depiction and, like, or is the reading of the movie that, like, oh, therapy is bad. And, you know, therapy is just, like, another system of control for the Matrix. And I think it's a legitimate reading that doesn't plumb deep enough.
I agree with that. Yes.
The thing is that the analyst has weaponized therapy. It's something that's, like, one of the great, like, 2021, like, very modern updates that Lana has brought to this new vision of the Matrix, that the analyst has brought to this new vision of the Matrix, which is that, like, we are more open as a culture now to talk about mental health. And that openness in the movie translates to, oh, this is a weapon I can use to control him. Like, we're all able to talk about therapy. People aren't afraid to talk about going to therapy. And now it's just another system of control. And the analyst can own Neo's memories and his trauma and his anxiety and his uncertainty. And that's just another way to put him in his place, which is as a fucking battery.
I didn't think about it as I was watching this movie. I honestly didn't think about it until we sat down to record this.
I'm standing up, but okay, make assumptions.
You know, we're talking about him being presented as a therapist and therapy, and we're using that word a lot. But in the movie, they don't use that word. He's the analyst. Tom refers to him as my analyst.
I actually wanted to ask about that because I don't – so, like, I know the difference between a psychologist and a psychiatrist, but what is the difference between a therapist and an analyst?
My conception of the word analyst is like, as it relates to the late 60s through the early 80s, like that was the era of having an analyst.
Woody Allen characters always had analysts. That will be the only reference to Woody Allen ever in this entire podcast.
I did a quick Google search and I haven't read this that thoroughly, but I've got an article from Psychology Today about the difference between psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. So psychotherapy, it seems, focuses on behavior. Psychoanalysis deals with the unconscious. That being the case, I guess it makes sense for the Matrix on a surface level, to use the word the analyst. But I also do think it calls back to that earlier era when you would call that person my analyst, and that sort of creative elite kind of feeling of this is a thing that I have because I have this particular status.
There's a status part of it for sure. It gives him a level up on Tom, right? It gives him he's high status. Tom is low status in all their scenes. There's also it works that he is a program. There is something antiseptic sounding about an analyst, you know? A therapist, right. You talk about your feelings, and an analyst is somebody who is more left-brained, and they're analyzing, and they're trying to dissect you. You know, it makes him more technical sounding, which really works with the reveal that he's a program.
The title, The Therapist, for a villain just is not good.
Everything about the therapy of the movie, I think, is really nicely discussed in a Vox piece by Emily Vanderwerf, who's a critic we've talked about on the show. And she's usually one of the first people that I want to read about when it comes to a Matrix movie. But in her piece, that's The Matrix Resurrection, spoilers, a movie actually about trauma, Emily talks about how on first reading, the movie might seem anti-therapy, but that the analyst is actually just a shitty trauma therapist. He's using therapy and trauma very superficially in a puddle deep, just the buzzword versions of them as another system of control. Emily talks a lot in the piece about her own experiences going through CPT, cognitive processing therapy, which is a way I'm only really learning from this particular piece of assessing and digging through your own childhood trauma and repressed memories, and how the movie kind of reflected and stimulated her thinking about her own experiences. We'll share the piece with people. It's super great and thoughtful and terribly well-written, just as all of Emily Vanderwerf's pieces are. But something that I really honed in on that she was talking about is that the analyst is also going into the meta reading of the movie that we went deep on when we talked about it as a legacy sequel, is that the analyst is also a toxic super fan. Right? What does he do? What does he reveal that he did? The Matrix was crumbling, and he had a way to fix it, which was to take these two dead people, these two icons, these heroes, and physically resurrect them and put them back in the same roles that they used to be in before. Emily writes, he doesn't allow them even the closure of death. He resurrects them and forces them back into the roles he likes best, ineffectual drones who are forever yearning to be together but never quite connecting. He wants legacy sequels. He's somebody who he wants another Star Wars movie, and he wants to see Harrison Ford put on the vest again and say all the old lines, and he wants another Ghostbusters movie and the fucking CGI ghost of Harold Ramis, which makes me want to vomit all over myself. But he's fucking that too. It's not just that he's exploiting therapy as a way to control Tom and keep close tabs on him, but he's also a fan. He genuinely loves them, but his love is this controlling, suppressing fucking hatred that smothers them.
In his reveal, he talks about how he first resurrected Tom because he didn't realize how integral Trinity was to the whole thing, and then ran into a ton of problems about how close he could keep them. Yeah, I like the read of him as a toxic fan. He built a whole new world that's just based on the old world. Literally a battery that runs on nostalgia.
Well, nostalgia and pain and suffering. His whole monologue that we butchered in the beginning, forcing Pinot Grigio into it. The more you suffer and the more you're upset, the more energy that you produce. He's just talking about Twitter. He's just talking about why I can't stop doom scrolling, because the more upset I am, the more I look, and my attention and my energy and my data that the algorithms can track to sell shit back to me, that's the product. It makes us miserable, but we can't pull away, and it just makes us more a part of their system.
And it fuels our anxiety and our heart palpitations and our brain chemistry, and just makes everything feed into whatever the machines want, which is, more chemical reactions that create more power.
Yeah. It wants submission. It wants compliance. It doesn't even care if you question the systems of control as long as you continue being a consumer.
The stuff about the dream paralysis that he talks about in that monologue.
Yeah. Ooh.
That shit hurt. That hits hard. He started saying that and I was like, oh God, you just tapped into just a universal human experience that now people are going to be thinking about in the context of this movie. And for sure, I've had nightmares since watching this movie in which I have that kind of dream paralysis. And I've woken up going, well, I guess the Matrix got more power out of me.
Have you ever seen it's a documentary called The Nightmare. Have you watched this one?
I have not.
Oh my God. You got to watch it, but also, you know, clear your sleep schedule for a few days afterwards. It's a documentary by Rodney Asher, who previously made a terrific doc about all kinds of crazy wackadoo fan theory readings into The Shining. He made a doc last year that was one of my favorites called A Glitch in the Matrix, which is all about like simulation theory and people who like really believe that we live in simulations. I think I mentioned it on the show before. But The Nightmare is him exploring sleep paralysis.
Oh, God.
And talking about how so many people who suffer from sleep paralysis experience the same recurring visions. Like they all see this shadow man with glowing red eyes and they can't move and they know they're in a dream, but they can't wake up from it. And the shadow man slowly approaches them. And the movie has reenactments of them, like reenactments of that shared vision. And it is genuinely horrifying stuff. Like one of the most frightening movies I've ever seen.
I don't want to watch it.
It's so good, Jamie. You should watch it.
I don't want to do it. But sleep is bad already.
I mean, I will say.
My body is bad and everything hurts.
After I saw that movie, I've never suffered from sleep paralysis before, but I definitely had the nightmare of a shadow man with glowing red eyes like that night.
Not going to do it.
Evocative stuff. But yeah, so the whole thing with the analyst for me, like it's what Bug says, right? It's what the Matrix does. It weaponizes everything that is important and everything that is like essentially sacred to us, everything that we love, and it turns them against us. And like what does he do? He takes Neo's memories and his experiences from the original trilogy and turns those into like he forces Neo to think of them as a video game. You know, that was just a expression of his like paranoid delusions, essentially.
This is your life, but it is actually a video game that you made with someone you hate.
He takes the concept of red pill, blue pill, and like a real son of a bitch, he prescribes Neo blue pills. Like that's not even helping in terms of a system of control. Like the actual blue pill, whatever that virtual blue pill is.
It's just a fucking victory lap.
It's just a middle finger in the face. Like I'm going to take this metaphor that Morpheus and his friends used to use that was so important to you. And I'm just going to like make you swallow that shit all day, every day. What an asshole. He's weaponizing all of it. He's turning it all into systems of control. And I think that is, for me, what is one of the very interesting like layers of subtext in the movie is like Lana Wachowski is taking a lot of critiques of the original movies and a lot of misinterpretations of the original movies. And then she herself, like the Matrix, weaponizes everything against us. She is folding those things into like, not to make it sound dry and dusty, but like into like the thesis of this film. She's talking about a lot of the stuff that people threw against the original movies.
Why is a movie having a thesis dry and dusty?
No, I'm not saying it is dry and dusty. I'm saying it sounds dusty. It sounds academic, you know? People are resistant to anything, especially in popcorn, that makes it feel like they have to do the work. Sometimes that's fair. Like when audiences first went to go see David Lynch's Dune back in, I think, 1984, like the studio was so nervous that people wouldn't understand what was happening that there was like a full page glossary that was handed out to people at theaters across the country that explained like all of the key terms and like history of the fucking universe from Frank Herbert's books. Like that's how little confidence they had in that movie. Like that's going to turn people off right away.
That's fucking wild. Yeah. I mean, if you handed me a glossary of terms before walking into a movie, I would probably not read it. Because if I need it to understand the movie, then the movie's done something bad.
So I'm just saying that this is on a spectrum with that. Like I describe a Matrix movie as requiring a thesis or having a thesis statement, and that's going to tune some people out. And I don't think this movie is like hammering you with like academia, but the shit's definitely in there.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know. I push back on that because I like it when media has a thing to say.
Yeah, especially when like big pop media has a thing to say. You know, things right. That are going to be seen by like tens or hundreds of millions of people. It's nice when, you know, somebody can cram some veggies in there with all the sugar and the candy.
And I think there's a lot of vegetables in this movie, a lot to chew on, a lot of fiber.
There are. One of the biggest critiques of the original Matrix movies that I think Lana is like explicitly addressing with this film is from Jean Baudrillard.
Jean Baudrillard.
Baudrillard. He was a French postmodern philosopher. He's actually name-checked in the first Matrix movie. Do you remember when it's in like the early scenes and the leather-clad pale people like show up at Neo's apartment and they knock on the door and they give him money in exchange for a disc with something on it. God knows what Neo is actually like trafficking in. Remember? But like Neo goes and he gets the like mini discs or whatever that he's going to give to them.
The book that he, the hollowed out book.
That's right. The hollowed out book is Simulacra and Simulation. So it's 1981. It was published by Jean Baudrillard. And I have a copy of it here. I will not lie. I have struggled through some of it only because it's, you know, a translation of, and a very lovely translation of like French postmodern philosophy, which is some pretty heady shit. And I basically had to read it out loud to myself just to understand so that I wouldn't have to like read it inside my brain 10 times over and over again. But so Baudrillard's whole thing that the Wachowskis were referencing and alluding to in the original movies is this philosophical concept in postmodernism that their reality doesn't exist anymore, that reality has been replaced by the simulation, like between mass media and ideology and nostalgia and politics and like branding, that all of these things have made it impossible to know what's real. You know, they're between subjectivity and how everything is a representation or a simulation or a lie, that there's no way to know what is actually true because truth is so subjective and so ephemeral. Essentially, to Baudrillard, the simulations have replaced what is actually real.
That is a dark read on the times. And like to have it in 1981, it definitely feels that way today.
Well, that's the crazy thing. I'm reading this book and it's like this was written 40 years ago. And like, man, I would love to know what that man would have to say about fucking today. Like there, let me read you this one passage. This was like catnip for me because you know my fondness for the Mouse House. Where is it? All right. And it's very hard for me not to like slip into a architect or Agent Smith cadence here. So you'll have to just bear with me. The imaginary of Disneyland is neither true nor false. It is a deterrence machine set up in order to rejuvenate the fiction of the real in the opposite camp. Whence the debility of the imaginary, its infantile degeneration. This world wants to be childish in order to make us believe that the adults are elsewhere in the real world, and to conceal the fact that true childishness is everywhere. That it is that of the adults themselves who come here to act the child in order to foster illusions as to their real childishness.
Okay. Yes, that was dense in its wording. But
he might as well be talking about the announcement from just a few days ago as of this recording that like Disney is planning to open a series of like Disney-themed living, like, communities where people can go and, you know, build their entire lives, where they're going to have, like, estates and condominiums and single-family homes called Story Living, the first of which is going to be in Coachella, which apparently, like, Walt fucking loved going there. I imagine not the modern conception of Coachella that we all think of. But yeah, like he might as well be talking about that, right? It's the Disney adult, right? The people who go there, and I say this, I know my voice sounds like it's dripping with acid and disdain, but like my particular take on like the Disney adult that I think Baudrillard is really hammering home here is that like you go there to it's nostalgia. It's traveling back in time. It's going to a place that allows you to be a child. What Baudrillard is saying is that like it allows you to pretend that you can be a child because there's other adults out there who are doing the adult work. Even though that's not actually true, because maybe everybody is engaging in this kind of like childish indulgence. And then it allows you to tell yourself that when you go back to your real world and you leave Disneyland, that you're actually adult and you're not really a child. But the experience that you had there and your desire for it is really all tied up into it.
I would like to say a small handful of things. First of all, I had not heard this announcement that Disney was creating living communities, and I'm profoundly distressed by it and I hate it. And then also, yeah, this idea that I don't think that Baudrillard is placing a value judgment on people having childish nature to them. Maybe he is.
No, that's 100% me. His problem is the lie that we don't even know if it is a lie, right? Like his whole thing with Disneyland is that it's, and he goes on in the book, is that it's a simulation of Americana. Parts of Disneyland are meant to represent small town America, and other parts are meant to represent the Jungle Cruise is almost like Manifest Destiny, and the Future Land is some kind of like the American spirit of exploration and innovation. And it's a way to like for Americans to reinforce for themselves and for the world, like what our values are. But then that itself is just branding. It's plastic. It's just a simulation of something. But then it comes to ultimately replace those actual values. And then so what's the real thing? Like what are our real values? What really does it mean to be an American? Like it's now multiple generations that have this like Disneylandified version of American values and how Americans present themselves reflected back to them. And now it's just internalized.
Right. So is the simulation now real? Is Disneyland actually America?
Is it any less a version of America than like any small town America, which is itself just like this idealized version of what white America thinks of itself? He's got one that totally blew my mind. He spends a lot of time in the book talking about Watergate and how Watergate isn't actually a scandal, and that the real problem with Watergate is the depiction of it as a scandal. That the Watergate is essentially like, and this is me very greatly paraphrasing, but like Watergate, the scandal, which is to say the press coverage of Watergate and then the political reaction to that press coverage, is essentially like the system self-correcting and depicting the criminality of the Nixon administration as something other than business as usual. And that the painting it as a scandal is a way for the system to create outrage to make us think that it isn't business as usual, and that people like Woodward and Bernstein and the Washington Post, which is itself like a for-profit paper, that through them essentially like putting the thumbs on the scale and saying this is not the way it should be and this is out of the ordinary and this is criminal behavior, is just the system itself, the political and the system of capital, telling the country like, no, it's really okay. Like, this isn't the way that things should be. And then the damn movie, like All the President's Men, this is immediately where my brain goes. And Baudrillard tells me that I'm living in a simulation, and he's totally right. The movie has replaced the actual event in our collective memories.
Jesus.
Right? Like, he talks a lot about how movies have replaced history because movies are so visceral and there it's this shared, like, visual, experiential, like, narrative of things that, like, for me to think about Watergate and Woodward and Bernstein, I'm thinking about Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford and the Alan J. Pakula movie. All the President's Men has replaced Watergate largely in our collective memory of it. And that's the way with most historical events. Like, you say Abraham Lincoln to me, and like 9 times out of 10, I'm picturing Daniel Day-Lewis.
Right, but how different is that? Like, did it replace history, or did it just replace the prior convention of passing down these stories, which itself was just as unreliable?
Well, I mean, that's his other thing, is that history itself is a simulation. There is absolutely no escape from simulation in Baudrillard's vision. Like, I mean, he's definitely not thrilled about this. This is all a depiction in the negative for him. I mean, Jamie, just look at what's going on right now. Like, we're recording this episode, and it's day two of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Jamie, what is the actual truth? What is actually happening over there?
I have thought about that every single news alert and like podcast that I've listened to and reading everything. I'm like, is all of this actually true? Is there like what narrative can I truly, like, firmly believe?
And the narrative that you firmly and truly believe is not the narrative that people who are, for example, fucking Fox News listeners believing, or people who are only getting Russian state propaganda being fed to them, which is different from how the actual experience of what's happening in Ukraine is. And none of it's, to Baudrillard, none of it's real. You know, it's all depiction. It's all representation. It's a narrative, a depiction that is replacing the actual reality. And everybody's version is so radically different as well. And that we can never actually get back to the truth.
Well, I'm feeling very despondent and depressed right now, Scott.
Yeah, it's
you've managed to take all of the wind out of all of my sails.
Well, that's what I'm here for, Jamie. That also, title of my memoir. This is like Baudrillard's beef with the original Matrix movies, right? So they name check him in the 1999 movie. Apparently, he says the Wachowskis people reached out to him about having some kind of involvement in the original movie, and it just didn't come to bear. But then in 2003, sometime between Reloaded and Revolutions coming out, he does this interview and he actually talks about the Matrix, and he drops this like quote that has become sort of famous in terms of people who like dig into the Matrix and just film critics in general. And he says that the Matrix is surely the kind of film about the Matrix that the Matrix would have been able to produce.
And he's being not nice.
No, but I think he's onto something. He's being critical. He's being critical of movies that are like using him and his philosophy in a way that I'm paraphrasing here, but like he thought that their interpretation of his work was a puddle deep, that it was like this very shallow examination of his work, and that his real issue is that the version of being trapped in a simulation that the Wachowskis depict in the original movies is closer to the Platonic model, where there actually is a real reality that can be returned to or restored.
And in his world, there is not a real reality.
Right. So he's talking about like Plato and the allegory of the cave, right? And the people chained up in the cave and the shadows passing by from the entrance of the cave on the wall. And that's an illusion that people are trapped with, but that if you can free your mind or if you can free your body, you can return to and remember that there is actually a reality that's creating those shadows and those projections, which is basically what the Wachowskis do in the Matrixes. They have this version where Neo is trapped in a simulation and nothing he knows is real, but there is actually a real world that he escapes to. Baudrillard's thing is all like that. It's like he mentioned something like The Truman Show as an example that is much closer to his actual philosophy, because like, how does The Truman Show end? The Truman Show ends with Truman transcending and realizing the prison that he's in. Spoilers for The Truman Show, I fucking guess. But then how does the movie end? He's going to escape, right? He's going to break through. He tells Ed Harris, his God in the sky maker, that, you know, I'm transcending. Good morning, good evening, and good night. And then what does he do? He walks out, closes the door, and cut to credits. So the audience themselves never actually escapes the simulation. So is there anything actually beyond the simulation? That's closer to what Baudrillard is talking about than what the Wachowskis put in the original Matrices.
Sure, but I mean, in the original Matrices, there were, you know, a couple layers that got pulled back even after we enter the quote-unquote real world. The architect and the layer of control that exists in the real world that no one's aware of in Zion. Then the reveal of the duality of Neo and Smith and their connection at the end of Revolutions.
Yeah, for sure. I think there's stuff in the movies that he's like not giving them credit for. But I also think just like in the straight up reality of that is depicted, that there's the simulation of the Matrix and then there is the real world, right? Like there are two realities in the Matrix. There's the simulation and there's Zion and like the desert of the real, which is something they took from Baudrillard.
He doesn't like being quoted.
That might be part of it. Yeah, maybe he's just quote averse. I don't know. He's a French philosopher who talks at great length about all of this. I feel like he's probably not as press shy as, for example, the Wachowskis always have been. In this 2003 interview, he's got this great quote about the problem with the Matrix. And let me just read this to you and then we can talk about it, because this is going to feed into one of Jamie's favorite topics, which is the evils of capitalism. The Matrix paints the picture of a monopolistic superpower like we see today and then collaborates in its refraction. Basically, its dissemination on a world scale is complicit with the film itself.
Say what now? Okay.
What he is saying here is that, like, all right, so we talked about this recently, right? That the metaphor of the Matrix, it's not really talking about fear of an AI uprising. It's talking about systems of control. It's talking about government and global capitalism merging together and creating an illusion of free will for all of us that we need to transcend and realize that we're all trapped in something, right?
Right.
But this is a like $150 million movie that is distributed by like a global media company and that it is seen on millions of screens. And just by the nature of its distribution and how people access it, the movie is then, as he's saying, is complicit in reinforcing the message that the machine wants you to hear. Like, I mean, think about it. The first movie especially, right? And I think they complicate this with the sequels. But, like, the first movie ends in this, it's not simple, but, like, Neo transcends. And then, like, if there were never any other sequels, you could walk away from the first movie thinking, oh, and then Neo's going to go fuck up the machines and, like, everything's going to be good. And reality will be restored and people will be liberated. Like, that's what Baudrillard is saying. That is the movie that The Matrix would want you to see. It wants you to experience a story in which it's exactly what the analyst is doing. It gives Tom this, like, this glimmer of the truth, which is, yes, you were trapped in an artificial, like, AI simulation to control you, but actually you have the tools of therapy. It wasn't actually real. You were able to transcend it, or you were able to funnel it into your video games, which was a helpful way for you to escape. He's saying, and I think it's fair, that the original movies were, they're compromised by the fact that they're part of the system that they're trying to critique.
That is a valid critique, I think. You won't be shocked to know that that the idea that this is brought into the minds of hundreds of millions of people worldwide, even though it's talking about breaking reality, that all resonates a lot with me because I hate all of the monopolist capitalism, and I can't fucking deal with the lack of nuance in the media that gets produced and shown globally. And I hadn't thought as much about The Matrix 1999 in a vacuum in a while. It without Reloaded and Revolutions. Because you're absolutely right. It paints this really simple picture that
it's triumphant.
Neo is he wins.
Yeah, it's like the philosophical sci-fi version of, like, you know, the Disneyfied version of race in America. Most, like, Hollywood movies about race, it's usually like it's either a white character who is better than all the other white characters in the racist South that is so, like, you know, segmented away from the rest of the world. And it packages it in a way where, like, your white character is better than all the racists, or where your lone black character who's standing up against, I'm thinking about a lot of, like, sports movies,
right?
Like fucking Remember the Titans or what is the Sandra Bullock one?
The Blind Side. Yeah.
Yeah. These movies that make it easy and digestible and allow a white audience to look at it and say, well, I would be that character. I would be the good character who's not a racist. And look, see this one black character played by Samuel L. Jackson is able to rise up over his position and things are okay now. It makes it easy for us. The Matrix is basically that, is the Baudrillard slight against it, which I think is fair. And I think Lana is incorporating it in this new one. Like, I think that's so much of what The Analyst is about. It's she's putting these critiques from Baudrillard, like, front and center, and showing that the analyst is, he is the Matrix. He is the system of control, that Neo's efforts in the first one were by their very nature, like, complicit with the system, and that there's no way to escape it. And that the whole character is about a response to this critique.
I mean, he creates a world in which the Matrix does produce, in this case, a video game called The Matrix. That's as direct an engagement of that critique as I can think of.
He said the Matrix is the kind of movie that The Matrix would have allowed, or is the kind of critique of The Matrix that The Matrix would have allowed, right? Tom's Matrix trilogy is The Matrix controlled by the analyst, allowing him to exercise those demons in a controlled way. And by him disseminating it to everybody else who's plugged into The Matrix, it makes them feel better about any of their glimmers of doubt of being trapped inside a matrix.
Now I want to, but also very much don't want to read Baudrillard.
Oh man, it's so good. Like it's also, you know, like you have to, not that I have a background in philosophy, but like I took a few philosophy classes in college and like this stuff is not entirely alien to me, but I don't agree with everything that's in here, but it's super good shit.
It doesn't say good things about the world we live in. And it's, I mean, as you're describing it, quite prophetic from 40 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, we talk so much on the show, like with the Lego sequels and just in general, but like talking about what I think is, like, you know, a societal ill, which is this obsession with nostalgia. Baudrillard says on fucking page 6 of this book, when the real is no longer what it was, nostalgia assumes its full meaning. Like, nostalgia for a thing has replaced actual connection and value that we took from the thing in the first place. Like, this is what we talked about when we talked about, like, how The Force Awakens and Jurassic World aren't about anything except how much we loved those original movies.
Right.
So, Jamie, this, you, what you were talking about before when I was prodding you about, you know, calling things New World wines and wines of the old world.
When you were being a dick to me earlier.
Well, you would have to narrow that down. But specifically when I was critiquing you about New World and Old World and how you're trying to get away from that. But, like, it's the language, it's the branding of those things that defines, for so many people, the reality of your wine world.
Right.
This is what you were making me think of when you're drawing comparisons and saying that there's so many parallels in all of these post-colonial areas in North and South America and in Africa and in Australian wines. But it's like, but your whole perception there is what I felt was just talking about it not being European is creating this false reality, this false linkage between all of them. Right. Like even language can't be trusted because language is built upon history and it's built upon culture. And that's built upon, you know, who conquered who and which language was dominant and which king dictated whatever. Like it's we're fucked, man. We're just fucked. It's just all systems of control.
That's why I'm trying to, like, exactly what you're saying is why I'm endeavoring to find new ways to talk about these things. And for sure, European and non-European doesn't get me where I want to be. It's better than old world, new world, because old world conveys a sense of, like, worldliness and knowledge and higher status. And new world, like, just the dichotomy there is very colonial and acquisitional and about conquest. European versus non-European also doesn't get me all the way there because we're just creating this bifurcated divide that doesn't necessarily have to exist, whether or not there are through lines that we can find. And similarly in movies and the media that we consume, like the words that we choose to describe these things really color our perception of them. Yeah, it's just being thoughtful about how we describe these things and how we talk about them, I think, is massively important. And maybe we're not going to ever break out of the simulation that Baudrillard is suggesting, but it could be better. We could have a better understanding.
Jamie, we can't even break out of the idea of a simulation. And he's not saying that there's one simulation. It's that everything is a simulation. And that we're in like a third stage simulacra simulation, which is like a simulation of a simulation based on the initial simulation. Like this podcast, Jamie, is a simulation.
God damn it, Scott.
It is. It is. I'm not like, you know, yeah, we're living in a simulation, man. Like it genuinely, this podcast is a simulation of a conversation. Anybody listening to this show thinking that like Jamie and I are this articulate and that our thoughts are so composed, don't hear the like dozens of minutes every week that I cut out of the show of just us like mouth breathing on the microphone and going,
Yeah, we do that a lot.
Yeah. Or like, I mean, we don't do it as much in the show now, but like in the early days, I used to restructure the conversations because we were so all over the place to create a sense of a conversation. Sometimes I just like ethically, I feel like, well, you know, shouldn't I just be more transparent? Shouldn't I just depict us the way that we really are? And then by me talking about that on the show, that's just another system of control. That's me trying to peel back the curtain and appear like I'm a real person to the audience. But really, it just makes me seem more sincere, which is just false. It's just not. The whole show is a lie, Jamie. It's all a lie. It's all bullshit.
All right. Bring it back. Calm down. Calm down. It's not a whole lie. We take a little bit of creative license. It could be described as a simulation, but we're not doing Watergate.
No, we're not doing water. But then that's the thing. Like every podcast is like this, or at least most of them, you know? And any podcast worth its salt finesses the recording a little bit. My justification for it is that I want the barrier to understanding for the audience to be as low as possible, and I want it to be like a clean auditory experience. So I think cutting out, you know, half of my wet breaths and 75% of your pregnant pauses is akin to like running a noise reduction and trying to like EQ our voices. Like it's just to make it sound better for the audience because our ears are so sensitive. But I'm also creating this false sense that, you know, you and I are like smart people who have like quick and rapid fire banter during our smart guy conversations about bullshit.
We're pretty smart though. I mean, at least I am.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to send you this Baudrillard book, Jamie, and then we'll see how fucking smart you feel after that.
I'm not in an emotional state to read about how everything is a lie. And the whole thing sounds very hopeless.
Well, I see. What's funny is that I don't feel hopeless with this. With this book, it feels like I'm understanding the truth a little bit more, or at least I'm understanding the illusions a little bit more. It's like, it's helpful that I'm reading this, and this would be at any time in the fucking whatever year this is, 2022. But like, I'm reading this while a war is breaking out, and Baudrillard is talking about at times like about terrorism and about violence, and like, who can know what the actual truth is when five different terror groups, you know, claim to be responsible for the bombing, and you can't trust your government, and you can't trust the police, and who even knows if the images that you're seeing are real? Like, I find this strangely affirming in that it gives me a little bit more power and makes me even more skeptical of media and news and ideology, you know?
I don't know how much more skeptical I can get. I just feel like I'm being lied to every second of every day. But yeah, I take your point. Understanding the illusion can absolutely help you feel closer to whatever truth there might be.
It's the first step, baby. You got to see the code before you can break through. Nobody's going to give you the red pill if you don't see the code first, Jamie.
Yeah, you're not wrong, my friend. You are not wrong.
Fucking red pills. When I was talking about Lana reclaiming critiques against the movies. So like, look at the analyst. In terms of, especially in the second half of the movie, after we know that he's the villain, like, he presents to me very much like a tech bro, right? Like, it feels like, oh, fuck you, Elon Musk. Like, Elon Musk, who we've talked about it on the show, like, famously tweeted that he was going to take the red pill, and then Ivanka Bleep said, oh, I'll take it right there with you. And then Lily Wachowski was like, fuck the both of you. his depiction as a toxic, egocentric tech bro, which he basically is, right? Like, he's a program, if you will.
God damn it. Yeah. Yeah, he definitely, he makes a quick flip from being a therapist who is showing compassion, whether or not you believe it, to being exactly what you just described, a tech bro who wants to mansplain things to people.
Well, right. And that's the other thing, right? Is that he like very quickly reveals this ugly, and I guess there's no pretty version of this, but like an ugly misogyny to him. His disdain and the despicable things that he says to Trinity and his defense of them. One of the ways that the Matrix we've talked about has been misinterpreted, I think willfully misinterpreted, is the goddamn pitiful sons of bitches, the men's rights advocates, who decided that red pill meant take the red pill and see that actually bitches are the ones controlling things and they're denying us pussy. Like, and it's that character is just an avatar for those smug, despicable people. And this ties back to a last episode and the one before when we talked a lot about Groff and about the meta text and about our parent company, Warner Brothers, is going to make a sequel to the trilogy and they're going to do it with or without us. Like, the analyst is the studio. He is the executive. He is the one deciding that telling Smith, you know, through the fucking corporate chain of command that they should go back and do another one, I think largely to continue to upset and antagonize Tom's anxiety and his paranoia.
Yeah. First thing, how is NPH so good at selling that he's a misogynist?
That's a great question.
Because we've mentioned How I Met Your Mother, that show, he's the worst misogynist. And then in this movie, it's just slipped in there. And why is there a program that hates women, first of all, but also...
that is an excellent point. Why is there a program that hates women?
But like, he clearly does.
Yeah. Oh, he has great disdain for them. He hates the women more than he hates the men.
It's bizarre. And NPH does a phenomenal job of selling it. And then on the studio exec level, like he also absolves himself of responsibility a little bit when he talks about quote unquote the suits. Like he talks about the structures even above him. This is a machine that while he's in control of it, he's not in total control of it. And at the end, like the suits have let him live.
Well, and that's the thing, right? That's the systems of capital, right? Capital, this is something Baudrillard talks about. Capital always wants to self-sustain. You know, capital is like almost divorced from morality, like it's its own system. And the capital of the Matrix world is energy, which is basically the capital of our world. It's energy that continue to self-replicate and reproduce. And as long as the analyst's new Matrix is able to generate enough energy for the machine world to go on, they'll let him do whatever the fuck he wants. And so his worst and basest instincts are allowed to like fucking run rampant, which, you know, sounds an awful lot like several extremely terrible and canceled people and terrible Hollywood people who have yet to be discovered to be the worst. It's all great, Jamie. It's all good. Everything is great.
Everything's fine. We're all happy. Everybody is okay.
Everything is awesome. But yeah, I think she's telling it like it is. And I think she's using this character to like to just call out a bunch of horse shit that is going on around her movies and around how her movies and her art have been exploited. And also in like a cubist refraction of like meta upon meta, she's folding in Baudrillard's critiques of her own failing to assess the context of the movie's distribution. Like she's literally talking about the film's origins and distribution in the movie.
Right. And she's using the analyst to do it. And she's weaponizing the casting of America's sweetheart, Neil Patrick Harris, someone who everyone loves. Like you say the words Neil Patrick Harris just on the street, people would be like, oh my God, I love that guy.
Yeah. And yet, like most of what we think of him from, like if you're old enough, like Jamie and I, geriatric millennials, to think of Doogie Howser, like fine, he was a great kid performer. But like most people, I would think for NPH, they would have a couple of main touchstones, right? You're going to have like maybe the NPH-essence. Let's definitely torture that one into the ground. Another bit of branding that ruins reality, Jamie.
Neil-essence.
No, that's bad, because that could be Neil deGrasse Tyson, everyone's favorite annoying Twitter uncle. Your touchstones for him could be Harold and Kumar, or they could be, like we've talked about, it could be How I Met Your Mother, or like for me, when I think NPH, I always think of his despicable, misogynist, controlling little shit character in Gone Girl.
I haven't seen Gone Girl. You know what performance I do think of him? I think of How I Met Your Mother first, always. And then second is Starship Troopers.
Jamie, I'm embarrassed that I didn't even think of him in Starship Troopers. But like that's interesting to me. Like, because like you're saying, like he's likable. Everybody likes him. We like when he hosts the Tonys and when he sings and dances on stage and when he undercuts his own image. But then like Barney is at best an anti-hero on How I Met Your Mother. And he's
very best.
He's a repulsive villain in Gone Girl. He's a repulsive, very watchable, delicious villain in this movie. And then he's a fucking Nazi psychic in Starship Troopers. Like, why do we like him? Why do we associate these good things with him when he's so good on screen as a villain?
Yeah, I really don't know. I do not have an answer for you other than he's just like magnetically charismatic.
I mean, that's how he gets away with it, right? That's how his characters get away with it. It's why he's so good at villains. Because the best villains are the ones that you love to watch, you love to hate. And he's eminently hateable on screen.
He really is.
And that's a compliment. That is a compliment to his performances. Or I don't know, maybe he just walks on set and like that's how he behaves. I'm not really sure.
Another one that actually does, I don't know, it's a complicated character that he plays, but during the writer's strike when he and whomever else produced Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. Because he's nominally a bad guy, but he struggles the whole time to do bad things. And he's only like rewarded in the end when he accidentally kills his girlfriend.
Yeah, it feels like the writer creator of that show is maybe revealing more of himself than any of us originally thought when that first came out.
Yeah.
Yeah, but let's not talk about him. Fuck that guy.
Fuck that guy. Is it time for Wife Takes, Scotty?
Well, it's not Wife Takes. She's not giving me takes on the wine. She did actually just confess this morning that she genuinely misses coming up with clever post-apocalyptic ways to kill you off every week.
God damn it.
Hey, I told her, and this is the straight up true. Like, I think that is by far the peak of this show so far. Not just her contributions, but I think 6 weeks of Jamie, how did you die in, you know, the zombie it's apocalypse pretty goddamn is good. Just great shit.
That was excellent content.
So she asks, she got two open-ended questions here, or one is open-ended and one is multiple choice, but we'll take it from there. So the first question that she poses is the analyst more likely to drink super specific and rare varietals of wine because he thinks he's superior to the masses, or is he more likely to drink mass-produced wines because he enjoys a hint of defeated mediocrity on the nose?
Oh my God. So I think in his persona as Tom's analyst, he would drink a beer. He would want to portray a folksy manner of being.
Hmm. Absolutely false. He drinks sherry, but please continue. I think in character, his fancy boy analyst drinks disgusting, disgusting sherry.
No way.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Oh, but he is a San Francisco therapist. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, I definitely know what you mean by that. And I agree.
It's one of those towns where especially people with money are more keyed in to like the geeky shit that I care about, but they use it for status. Anyway, I still think that he would drink a beer because he wants to convey being a man of the people. I do think that once he takes his glasses off and becomes tech bro, studio exec, misogynist, the analyst, he just drinks the most expensive shit because it is the most expensive shit.
Right. It's like wiping your ass with silk.
Exactly.
All right. So Toddy's next question here. She says, no right answer, multiple choice. Which psychiatrist's office trope does this wine most resemble? A bust of Freud on the mantle. B, the phrase, our time is almost up. C, the phrase, you've made a real breakthrough here today. Or D, a tastefully yet obviously expensively decorated office.
Oh my God, she's the worst.
I'm gonna throw my own in here. And E, the stereotype of like an on-screen therapist who clearly is not paying attention and is just like doodling cartoons on their notebook when they're supposed to be writing down your dreams or some shit.
I like C.
The phrase, you've made a real breakthrough here today?
Yes.
All right, so Jamie, what about this bitter-ass fucking grapefruit high-alcohol wine makes you think you've made a real breakthrough here today, Jamie?
I don't – there's just something – it's that like – it's for me, once again, because your perception of this wine is obviously completely different from my perception of this wine. But for me, this wine is very easy drinking. It's kind of delightful and it has a lightness to it. It makes me think of maybe having a drink after a long day of work, that sort of relief. And the idea of doing a bunch of work with your therapist and your therapist giving you the validation of having made a big breakthrough, that lines up with that experience for me.
Jamie, I'm having a bit of a revelation thanks to my good buddy, Jean Baudrillard, which is that all of your obtuse, ridiculous, euphemistic ways to describe wine, that's the simulation right there. There's no truth to any of it. You can't describe it. You've allowed big wine to fill your brain with all these nonsense of ideas about how you should describe it. You're just using language to obfuscate that there's no truth. There's no such thing as wine, Jamie. There's no such thing as Pinot Grigio.
Yeah, I mean, I could say the same fucking thing back to you, asshole. Like, there are no movies. Movies aren't real. They're all a simulation, and especially the way you talk about them and describe them and metatextually analyze them is the simulation. There are no movies.
I agree. It's just the content slurry and me talking about them as films or work of artists or part of a conversation within the community and how we did... No, it's all just horseshit, Jamie. It's just the content slurry from the branded Dream Factory. None of it's real. It's all bullshit.
The content slurry from the branded Dream Factory.
Yeah,
that is a phrase.
Well, speaking of content slurry, I think we got to start turning off the drip on this one here. So, Jamie, why don't we wind it down? Let's let people know how we're landing this plane for the final installment of Pinot Grigio versus The Matrix Resurrections. Where are we going next?
for our sixth and final episode of this miniseries. We are drinking the 2020 Fossil and Fawn Pinot Gris Rouge. That's right. It's rouge. It's made into a red wine, baby. The 2020 vintage has very, very spotty availability. Suggested retail price is around $30 if you can find it, although the 2021 is likely to drop within the next month or so. When it does, you can get it Winery Direct or at your hippest local retailer.
Where did we get it from? From Winery Direct?
No, we got it from our hippest local retailer, Wineworks, in Marlton, New Jersey.
Ah, fancy them.
All right. Can you tell us how we're landing this plane on the movie side? What's the final statement that you want to make about the M4 tricks?
Well, so we've been kind of building to this the whole time. And the final installment of our miniseries on Matrix side is going to be talking about the movie's aesthetic, what some have dubbed its anti-aesthetic, and in particular, we're going to talk about the action. There was a big critique of the movie when it first came out that it doesn't look like the original Matrix movies. A lot of people didn't think it looked good, and they thought that the action was all bad. And those of us who came to its defense were roundly critiqued as saying, so you're just saying you like that it looks bad. Why can't you just say that it looks bad? And I don't think that it does, and I don't think that's why a lot of its defenders, like myself, really appreciate the aesthetic of it. So we're going to talk about how it looks, why it looks the way that it looks, and also why the action is such a radical departure and how all of that ties into everything that we talked about in today's episode, believe it or not.
Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Thank you.
Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com with any questions, queries, concerns that you might have. Make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. And word of mouth, please tell your friends.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me. Our social media presence is thanks to the fine work of Jamie Harrison Rubin, sitting virtually right across from me. There is no such thing as reality. And our new art that you are all hopefully enjoying as of our recording of this episode is thanks to friend of the show and longtime friend of ours, Ross Kennard. Thank you, Ross, for revealing Jamie and I our true that we're Muppets and always have been.
I think everyone's always known that I'm a Muppet, but yeah. Now you've been outed as a Muppet.
It is known and I embrace it. Yes.
Remember, everyone, please drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
I do not promise. I do not co-sign this. I don't think anything's good for anyone. Okay. Goodbye, everybody. Duck and cover.
Oh, my God.
What do you want me to say, Jamie? Now. What do you want me to say? What do you want me to say?
Goodbye, everyone. Duck and cover.
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
It's not the worst advice. By the way, the whole duck and cover thing, part of the simulation.
God damn it, Scott.
All right, I'm hitting stop now.